Hi, I'm Sanjay, and I'm a serial entrepreneur for the kicks, and I also invest in startups.
And I'm Shannon, a recent college grad working on building my first company.
And this is Startup Days,
the show where we take a behind-the-lens look at starting and growing a company from the perspective of founders and investors. Hey, Startup Days listeners, Shannon here, recording from Prototype Prime. On today's episode, Sanjay chats with Laura Hodson. Laura is the president and CEO of NowCorp, a revolutionary payments company for B2B. NowCorp was inspired by the success of her previous startup, Nourish, which sold spill-proof purified water for infants and toddlers. Among her many accomplishments, Laura has served as the CMO and COO at Dewberry Capital Corporation, the executive vice president of Dunk, a footwear and apparel company founded by Shaquille O'Neal and Mike Piazza, and senior vice president of the retail and consumer products division of IXL, now Cyent. Laura holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and a bachelor's degree in aerospace engineering with highest honors from Georgia Tech, where she was also a heptathlete.
And I have a character flaw, which is if you tell me something's the hardest, that's what I want to do.
Laura provides insight into milestones you should celebrate.
Always make sure that we don't get so far ahead of ourselves that we celebrate a sale as opposed to delivery.
And how to build on your past experiences to advance your career.
I just realized there had to be a better way to help small businesses grow faster.
After the conversation, Sanjay and I will answer a listener question. If you have a startup question or any random question, really, hit us up at Startup Days Pod on Twitter or DM us at Startup Days on Instagram. Now, here's Laura.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us what you're doing now, and then we'll kind of go backwards. And talk about the other stuff. So
Right. What
are you doing right now?
Well, right now, we started Now Account, or we call it Now Corp, but our product is Now Account, almost 7 years ago, 8 years ago now. And we started it because of a problem I was having with my last company, which was a manufacturing company that was growing so quickly that we were really growing to death. And we were getting larger and larger orders from companies, and they were taking longer and longer to pay. And everybody told me I had a working capital issue and I should go get a loan. But I didn't. I knew that at that stage of my business's development, putting debt on the balance sheet for that use was going to eventually constrain my growth, not help it. So I just realized there had to be a better way to help small businesses grow faster, and to do it by using a payment solution as opposed to necessarily a funding or a lending or a financing solution. And I realized that because I was actually sitting at lunch one day, banging my head against the wall about managing this growth. And it occurred to me that that restaurant never waits to get paid. Even though when I walk out, I haven't actually paid yet. I gave them a credit card.
Right.
But they get paid that day, even though I'm not going to pay my credit card bill till later. And I realized that that same type of transaction is very rare in the world of business to business or business to government. So we created Now Account, which is the first payment system that allows a business to get paid immediately when they deliver their good or service to another business or government in a way that feels like taking a credit card. So if your customer offers you a card, awesome, you should take it all day. But if they don't and they want an invoice and they want the ability to pay later, you can use your Now account to get paid immediately, and it feels like taking a credit card. Your customer does nothing different.
Yeah, I've never thought about that. I maybe start asking restaurants if they'll do like 90-day net terms for the meal that I just had.
Well, you know what's funny? It will not work. I can guarantee you that. Because in order to do that, they would have to go borrow money from the bank,
right.
And the bank would never lend them money for
that. Yeah, exactly.
But the funny thing is, it used to work that way. If you were to go back and ask your parents or your grandparents what their experience used to be, they probably would go to the local restaurant or local store every month to pay the tab.
Pay the tab.
I mean, the show Cheers would never have existed if Norm hadn't had a tab.
That's right, actually.
So if you think about it, my mother used to get the bulk of her credit from merchants, not from the bank.
Right.
And that all went away when the credit card came out because those retailers didn't really want to fund my mother, but they did it as a sales tool. I mean, it got her to buy more stuff.
Well, but they also had a personal relationship. So I wonder if the advent of credit cards has reduced that personal relationship that retailers have with their customers.
Probably. I mean, the interesting thing is the credit card was really not enabled to grow to the scale we see today until long distance phone charges became so low or essentially free.
Right.
Because imagine, you're right, when there were tabs, it's because they knew their local customer. They knew where they lived. They knew how to get to them.
Right.
And they knew something the about them. That's
gonna,
right.
You're not going to get them.
That's how
credit.
You did underwriting, right? Was you went to church and remembered who did and didn't pay their bills. But when long distance charges were, you know, low enough that you could actually ping someone's credit score or find out about them,
right,
then the credit card became something that a person who lives in Atlanta like myself could use in any place in the world.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your background. Where were you born and raised?
Yeah. So, well, I was born in upstate New York. We moved to Atlanta when I was 5 because my father had the opportunity to transfer and my mother hated snow. So we came to Atlanta. Yeah. So, I mean, I really grew up here in Atlanta.
We'll claim you as one of ours down here.
Yeah, it's close. Yeah. So, you know, I grew up here in Atlanta. I went to Georgia Tech for my undergrad. Go Jackets. Have a degree in aerospace engineering. And most people are like, why in the world did you pick that?
Yeah.
And I have a character flaw, which is if you tell me something's the hardest, that's what I want to do. And I don't know where that came from, but I love impossible challenges.
Yeah.
So I really at the time had been interested in bioengineering, but Georgia Tech didn't have that major at the time.
Right.
And so I studied aerospace engineering, loved it. And in my mind, it was the best education in terms of problem solving I could have ever had. It's also great for all the rocket science jokes.
Yeah.
You know, when people say, come on, it's not rocket science, I'm like, just in case, we got that covered.
Yeah. How many years did it take you to get out?
I got out in 5. So I was on the
pretty
normal plan. And I was a scholarship track athlete. So I track and field there. I was a heptathlete.
Heptathlete.
Yes.
Wow.
You know,
okay.
When you can't focus on one thing, do 7.
So what events is that? Heptathlon.
The shot put, the javelin, the long jump, the high jump, the 100 meter hurdles, 200 and 800. And you know what I should have realized then is that was the precursor to the fact that I was going to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Because I think I just have unmedicated ADD.
Yeah.
And I have to always do lots of things.
Yeah. I think that's true of a lot of entrepreneurs, honestly. We just think about a lot of stuff all the time. So out of those 7, which was the favorite event for you?
Gosh, you know, growing up, I was always good at the throwing events, which is funny because I don't look like someone who would throw things.
Yeah.
There's times when I'd like to throw things at people, but so I was sort of above average at all of them, and which is what makes a good heptathlete, unless you're someone amazing like Jackie Joyner Kersee and you're actually the best at several of them.
Right.
So I just always, I loved the jumping and I loved the throwing. So more the field events.
Okay. Okay. So not the running as much necessarily.
No, which is funny because I love to run, but
interesting. So came out of Georgia Tech.
Did
you work for anybody or did you just straight into entrepreneurship?
No, it was interesting. I was actually selected to study in Japan. So I was one of 20 students selected to go study in Japan. And
while you were at Georgia Tech.
While I was at Georgia Tech. And I thought, why in the world would I do that? That is not on the Laura Hodson 5-year plan. But one of my advisors said, when would you ever get the chance to do something you would never do?
Right.
And it's rare that I don't have an answer, but I didn't have an answer. So off I went to Japan. I had never left the country before.
Where in Japan?
I was in a small town called Koryama in Fukushima Prefecture.
Oh,
so about 4 hours north of Tokyo.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had to sign an agreement that I would use no English. And my charades got really good.
Did you know any Japanese before you went?
So when the Defense Department selected us, we went to Rose Holman Institute of Technology over the summer and did an intensive language program.
Okay.
And then my junior year at Tech, I had to do weekly phone call tests with the Defense Department to see if I could survive.
Okay.
And it was amazing. It was the best thing I ever did because it put me so outside my comfort zone.
Yeah.
And that was really, it gave me a chance to not only be extremely uncomfortable, but to look back on my own culture and my own decisions from a totally different perspective. And that was really when I realized, I hadn't even interviewed for jobs. I had a full fellowship to do a PhD in engineering, and that's what I thought I wanted to do, because right. everyone had said, oh, you could be the first female aerospace engineering professor at Tech. But it wasn't until I got to Japan when I sort of looked back at myself and said, I love problem solving, but I don't think I want to do that. Yeah. I think I want to go out and tackle practical problems and actually help change the world. Which is a challenge when you come back and you have an interview for jobs and you're like, okay, now I don't want to go do a PhD in aerospace engineering.
Right. Were you already in the program for getting a PhD?
Yeah. I mean, well, I had already been accepted into it. That's okay. what I was going to do when I got back.
Yeah.
So lucky for me, USA Today used to name the top 20 students in the country, and I was one of the 20. And so I got calls from people like McKinsey and others saying, hey, would you like to do consulting? And right. I didn't even know what that was. I was like, I don't know. What do you do?
And they were like, consult. And you're like, I still don't get that.
I went in for my first consulting interview, and it was one of these case interviews, which nobody told me about those.
Right. Not as an engineer. You don't get to know about that.
No, no. So I remember sitting there across from a very well-dressed, very sort of stern gentleman who said, if you wanted to know at any point in time how many quarters are in Lenox Mall, how would you figure that out? And I looked at him and I said, is that what you do? Because that's not very interesting to me. And he died laughing. He's like, nobody's ever said that to me. I said, well, if that's indicative of what we're going to be doing here, that's really
I'm
not
out.
What I, and he was like, no, we just want to see how you think. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that I can do for you.
Right.
So, yeah, that was my first case interview.
So what ended up happening? Did you get
the
job?
So he ended up calling me and said, I don't really know what to do with you. You're super smart, but you have no business background. But he was leaving to go start a new strategy group at what was then Anderson Consulting. And he said, I don't know what to do with you, but you're really smart. Do you want to come help me start it? So that's really kind of my first entrepreneurial, venture, was to be the first person in this group.
Yeah.
And from there, I've never had a job someone had before me. I'm always the one,
that's awesome.
Not only do I think outside the box, I don't think anybody ever gave me a box.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a very similar problem for myself. So how long did you last at that first gig?
So, I was there for 2 years. Shortly after I took that, I had been a finalist for a Rhodes Scholarship.
Uh-huh.
Didn't get that, but I was sort of in the application mode. So I thought, well, I'll go ahead and apply to business school. I'm not going to go for a few years, but at least I'll just do it for practice.
Right.
But then I ended up getting accepted to the school I wanted to go to, which was Harvard.
Yeah.
But I put it off for a year because I was working with the Olympics in Atlanta.
Okay.
So I stayed with the consulting group for about 2 years while I finished up with the Olympics and then went off to business school at Harvard.
Okay. Oh, so they were one of the consulting firms that worked on that whole shebang here?
No, I had interviewed. They had a program called the Envoy Program, which was basically the ambassadors.
Yeah.
And you lived in the village with the athletes and you were their go-between. So I was originally selected to be on the Japan team because I, my newly minted Japanese language skills.
There you go. And how are your Japanese skills now? Are they still around?
I understand it. If somebody is speaking Japanese, I understand what they're saying. My response time is really clunky because I don't use it very often.
Searching for the words, the vocabulary is the hard thing. Yeah.
But I think it.
Right.
Like if I'm around, interestingly enough, if I'm around people not speaking English, my brain reverts to Japanese. Okay. I just start thinking in Japanese.
So you got selected for this
program. So I started working with the Japanese team, and then about midway through the training, they said, how would you like to work on the Lebanese delegation? My response was, wow, I don't speak French or Arabic, but other than that, it's pretty logical.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we just think you'd work really well with them. So again, I love a challenge.
Right.
It was an area of the world I knew nothing about. So I was one of the envoys to the Lebanese delegation during the Olympics, which was fascinating.
And Lebanese folks are a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
My Japanese wasn't very helpful, but yes.
But most of them, I would imagine,
most
probably spoke
of them
English.
Speak English.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And by then, my charades were, I could do charades anyway.
Yeah. Did you interact with any heptathletes?
Not
is the heptathlon? No, it's the decathlon.
Decathlon is men and heptathlon is women.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay.
But the Lebanese delegation didn't have a heptathlete.
Okay.
So the one The one athlete, the female athlete
on their
team.
Did you volunteer? You say, hey, I could just be on
that's
your
right.
team?
Just,
I could do that event
exactly.
for you.
Give me a uniform. So I spent a lot of time. They had a lot of table tennis players and wrestling. And so each country has, you know.
Its specialty.
Most people are not like the United States where they're fielding athletes in every category.
Right.
But it was fascinating. It was most fascinating to me was what happened off the playing fields. Because when we were in the Olympic Village, you don't realize it's the one time when the entire world lives within a square mile of each other.
Right.
And so countries that, you know, on the political arena don't get along, you see the human side of people.
Did you see any kind of interactions there that you were disappointed by, surprised by, like people didn't get along?
I think more positively surprised, you know, seeing athletes from countries that are not supposed to interact, having lunch together, or even, you know, during opening ceremonies.
So
when
like
we were
the
down,
Lebanese were hanging out with the Israelis, like that's
during the opening ceremonies, when we were all in the center of the field, the head of the Israeli delegation walked up and asked me to introduce him to the head of the Lebanese delegation.
Really?
And of course, my brain is going through all the protocol, like, are we allowed to do this? But that's what was amazing.
Yeah.
Is, you know, when you take all the political stuff away, at the end of the day, they're just people, and they're people who love their sport and they love their country.
Right.
And, you know, to be able to realize that each other is not as different as they think.
Okay. So you got out of the Olympics and then headed up to Harvard.
Yep.
Spent 2 years?
2 years.
2 years doing that. What did you think? How do you compare that to Georgia Tech?
You know,
easier,
everyone
harder.
Everyone asked that question. Which is harder, Georgia Tech
or
Harvard?
We're Georgia Tech people,
I know
so
we want to know.
Because we always think that Georgia Tech
that's
is
right.
the pinnacle.
Well, I will tell you, Georgia Tech is harder. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the difference is, you know, having come out of Georgia Tech, where I'd already done five calculuses and advanced engineering math, there's very little sort of technical information that would have challenged me at Harvard.
Right.
The difference is, while Georgia Tech is harder in terms of the topical content, Harvard is more work, meaning they pile so much work on you. And what they want you to figure out is you can't read it all.
Right.
But you still have to make a decision.
Right.
So what they're trying to teach you is to filter through all that information and get comfortable with 80% and still making a call.
Yeah.
And so it takes a while. As an engineer, you know, I wanted to read everything. I needed to know all the information. It's
do the analysis of every detail.
Everything. So, and then what you realize is you're not supposed to do everything.
Right.
You can't.
Yeah.
And that's what they're trying to teach you is get comfortable with, number one, using your teammates around you to fill in areas of expertise that you don't have.
Right.
But then also being able to figure out what are the most important points, collect those points, make a decision and go.
Yeah.
So
it sounds like you probably would believe that your experience there at Harvard has really served you well as an entrepreneur, because that's all entrepreneurship, right? You never have full details.
Now, at the time, I remember saying to one of my professors, when you talk to a lot of engineers, they'll say, in hindsight, had I known all those landmines were there, I never would have had the courage to go forth across the field.
Yep.
So at the time I was like, are you benefiting us by teaching us where all the landmines are, or am I going to now be more afraid to walk through?
To go forward,
But I think in the end you realize that it gives you the confidence to know how to deal with one that you didn't see coming and how to anticipate where they might be.
Yeah.
So yes, it does help. And I think the mix, you know, when I was coming out of Georgia Tech, everyone said, you should go to Wharton or you should go to Chicago because engineers do really well there.
And finance and those kinds of topics. Yeah.
And then a friend of mine said, Laura, why would you go somewhere that plays to your strengths? Why wouldn't you go somewhere that plays to your weakness?
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting, you know, if I'm already good at the analytical side, yes, I could go somewhere where that's going to be easier for me, but why not go somewhere that kind of trues up the side that I'm not as confident on?
Right.
So
coming out of Harvard, what was next for you?
So coming out of Harvard, I was recruited to go back into consulting, et cetera. And my
now even more so, right? You've got the MBA and the engineer.
Now you do know what you're doing. but my entrepreneurial finance professor, Bill Salmon, basically was like, you already know you can do that, and you've got so many great ideas.
Right.
And his answer wasn't go start your own business. His answer was, why don't you go work with people who are starting their own businesses, which I had kind of done at Anderson because it was a new group.
Right.
So he introduced me to Bill Nessie, who had just joined IXL. Okay. He had been an investor in IXL through Greylock Ventures and was on the board and had just accepted the president position. And so he called, and I actually started while I was still a student up at Boston. He and I were on the phone, and I was doing analysis from my my apartment up in Boston.
And how early on was this at IXL? How big of a company were they?
I think I was like employee number 26.
Okay, so you were really early on.
Yeah, it was really, Bert had acquired a couple of companies and put them together to create IXL, and we were just getting ready to start scaling.
Okay. So then you came back down after leaving Harvard.
That's right.
Were with them for how long? Because they went public at a point.
Yes. So I left just before we went public.
Okay.
It was interesting. So when I joined, I was initially doing, Bert was acquiring lots of businesses. I think we acquired 40 some odd businesses in a couple of years.
And for those that don't know what IXL is, because it's now, I remember it, but there's some
IXL
new people
was
that don't.
Really kind of the first at the time. They were building websites initially. Yeah. I mean, this was when the internet was just coming out.
Websites.
And so when I first joined IXL, it was mostly businesses would hire them to get an internet presence. Nobody really knew what that was. So for a lot of people, it was still just brochureware.
Right.
But then it started to get into, now we need to integrate with core systems. Right now we need to use the internet not just as a brochure, but as an actual functioning part of our business model.
Right.
And so it quickly became more systems integration than just brochureware.
Right.
What I loved about it was the most amazing collection of people I'd ever worked with, because it's the first time I'd been in a business where you had the analytical sort of strategist, just like you would have had at a consulting firm, but sitting right next to them were the most amazing creative graphic artists, animation experts, etc. And then sitting next to them were the technology integration folks, that you would have had at the big technology firms. And having those different people work together is awesome.
Yeah.
When
it works. And it worked for a while for IXL.
It worked great.
Went south after you left. Basically, you leaving caused the whole thing to implode, I think.
There's certainly no cause and effect relationship there. But I will say I was hired away by a client. So part of why I left was that I had a client I had worked with to build their business plan, raise the money for them, and they wanted me to come run the company. But part of it, too, is I started to feel like we were growing so fast. And when I had first joined, every Friday we would celebrate a successful delivery of a project. But we were starting to grow so fast, we were starting to celebrate getting a new client. But you haven't delivered anything yet, right? Like, you've only won the right to play.
Right.
And it was such an interesting learning for me, because now with Now Account, we are, again, growing very quickly. But I always make sure that we don't get so far ahead of ourselves that we celebrate a sale as opposed to delivery.
What do you think about when startups celebrate raising money?
It is one of my biggest pet peeves. And,
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
When I'm up at Harvard, people tend to promote, this business raised $20 million. And my first thought is, but what are they going to do with the $20 million? If they turn the $20 million into $100 million, awesome.
Right.
But if they take the $20 million and nothing happens, why is that a celebration? So in my mind, raising money is the right to play. You've earned the right to play, but you haven't won the game yet.
Right.
And I think it's the wrong metric. I think we focus so much on raising money. I get why you say that's value creation, but I don't think it is yet.
Yeah.
I don't think that's value creation. I think you raise the money in order to create value, but you haven't done it yet.
Yeah. I talk about this often. I agree completely with what you're saying. I feel like it's just moving money from one pocket to another.
Right.
You haven't actually done anything.
You haven't
yet.
Done anything.
I mean, I guess part of the celebration should be like, now I cannot have to spend time raising money anymore.
True.
That's a great thing.
And maybe we should celebrate that you told a good enough story to get $20 million.
Right. And I think that's what that is in a lot of ways.
Right.
But it's also a broadcasting of somehow of credibility that you've convinced people. That means you're somehow credible.
And I think it causes us subconsciously to focus on the wrong point.
I agree. Yeah.
Just like, you know, it really was the beginning of the end when we started celebrating, oh, we just won a $40 million deal. But until you deliver on it, you can't say you've successfully created anything.
Right. That's not your money yet.
And you start to trip over yourself. You know, you get too far ahead of yourself. So we, you know, at Now Account, we have raised small amounts of money as we've needed it. Very anti what any business school would tell you.
Right.
And we've
Have you announced any of them when you raised them?
Never. Okay. Never once. Not even really, not even internally. I mean, people know that we've got investors and they love, you know, the annual shareholder meetings,
right.
They meet them, et cetera. But even internally as a team, we have never celebrated raising money.
Yeah.
We did celebrate the, you know, successfully doing our bond issuance back in Q4.
Okay.
Because
how much was that bond issuance?
So we had $100 million bonds
wow.
approved.
That's something to celebrate.
Well, the celebration was less the fact that we got the bonds. It was more the fact that we had unlocked the last sort of empty box that to check on our business model, right? So the fact that we had now done that opens up almost limitless inventory for us.
Right.
So it was really the impact of it that we celebrated, not
it. It was the last celebration before all the work started.
Right, right.
Because you're telling all your employees that, oh man, get ready. It's a lot of work.
Get ready because, now the pipeline's about to fly.
But fun. Fun
right.
work.
Oh, yeah. Right. But I think the other thing that's interesting is so many entrepreneurs get caught up in what they create. It's almost like your ego is wrapped in the widget you designed or the service that you designed. And I find that when you get so focused on that, you don't listen very well.
Right.
Because if I design this great widget and I show it to you and you say, wow, Laura, that's interesting. You know what you could do with that? And you give me suggestions.
Yeah.
I'm not listening because instead I'm defending, right? I'm saying, oh, but did you see how cool my widget is?
Yeah.
It's almost like I take offense to the fact that you think I should do something different. But if your ego, if your passion is in the so what or the impact of your good or service, then any suggestion people give you is welcome.
Right.
Because you could change anything about Now Account tomorrow and I wouldn't care.
Right.
What you can't change is the impact it has on people.
Yeah.
Right. You can't change that businesses call us every day and say, I tripled my business because of you. I hired 10 new people because of you. So our focus as a company and what we celebrate internally is impact.
Yeah.
Not what.
Do you guys track those metrics when companies say that, hey, you let me do this?
Absolutely.
Do that. Yeah.
In the state of Georgia alone over the last couple of years, our clients have created 3,000 jobs.
Because of the work
because
that you
guys
do.
Because of Now Account. Because of the fact that they're getting paid immediately and not having to wait for someone to pay an invoice, which means they can take that money that they've already earned and buy more equipment, hire more people, take a larger contract.
And how many people are you at Now Account? How many employees?
We are about 35 now.
So 35 people have basically translated into 3,000
jobs. How's that for leverage?
Right?
That's awesome.
That's incredible. Right?
Yeah.
So let's talk real quick about some of the other startups that you've had before Now Account and kind of after all of this other stuff. Tell me about some of the interesting ones, the successes and the failures.
Well, so coming out of IXL, I went with this client, which was Shaquille O'Neal and Mike Piazza.
Oh, wow.
Had teamed up with three of Nike's first employees to create a just-in-time footwear company.
Okay.
So think Dell computers for your tennis shoes.
Okay.
And the idea was that typically the lead time on footwear manufacturing is very long and there's a fashion element to it, right? There's a performance element and a fashion element. And trying to get those right is really hard because you're manufacturing them a good 9 months before they're ever going to hit the market. And so this idea was, look, if people could go online, they could pick the outsole they want and the midsole they want and all the performance elements as well as the cosmetic elements. I want it to be blue and I want my school logo on it or I want my name on it. And so we worked with the largest manufacturer in Asia to build a facility in Macau that could do this just-in-time assembly of footwear.
Of just like one-off pair of shoes.
Right. And then we worked with UPS and came up with a really interesting import model where each day each one would be boxed up and labeled for the eventual customer's address, but they'd be all shrink wrapped onto a pallet and they'd go sort of by hovercraft over to Hong Kong to be put on a plane over to the US. And when they would land in LA, you'd break open the shrink wrap and you'd scan each one and they'd go onto all the brown trucks. So we could pretty much get your custom footwear to you in a week or so.
Wow.
The interesting thing is
from order time to then build and deliver to you.
So all the components were waiting, and when your order came in, the shoe was assembled, and then it was packaged up and sent over. We were probably ahead of our time. We know this because, you know, trying to get one shoe into each person's hand is really hard from a marketing perspective. So we kind of pivoted and started doing custom collections for different retailers where East Bay could order their collection and customize it. Or imagine the local Foot Locker who knows that the high school's colors are red and black could do a bunch of red and black.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, 2000, let's see. So that was in 2001, you know, the internet sort of economy bursted.
Everything imploded.
Yeah, everything imploded. And we ended up licensing the brand to Starter. And then I came back to Atlanta and started something else.
So I got to ask, how many shoes did Shaq order? Because I'm sure this was all about him.
Shaq actually wore a new pair every game.
Every game.
Yeah. Okay. He puts a lot of work on his shoes.
Yeah. Wow. He's a big guy.
He is a big guy.
Yeah. But how many orders did he do through this? Like, did he order any shoes for himself? Like, just tooling around the house?
We just made shoes. I mean, we never saw his orders. His were made special. So they just rolled off the line.
Yeah. Because I imagine he can't go to Starter or Foot Locker and get his shoes.
No. In fact, most of the NBA players, there's a specialty store actually here in Atlanta that they get their very large shoes at.
Yeah. His feet are huge, aren't they?
Yeah, 22, 23.
And you still have
one
of his shoes, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's good for when I speak.
Being a heptathlete, how far can I throw it? Have you tried?
You know, I had it under my arm going through an airport one time, and just because it doesn't fit in my roller bag unless I want to pack no clothes, which of course makes me realize how must this man pack, right? Like, imagine the size of a suitcase.
You got to wear your shoes.
So I had tucked it under my arm, and I'm rushing through security, and I just had my roller bag and my computer bag in that. And this woman came out and said, "That is the coolest shoe. I mean, no, that is the coolest purse I've ever seen." I was like, purse? I don't have a purse. And then I realized she was talking about the shoe. It is bigger than most purses. But I think what I learned there that was interesting is I absolutely had the passion for what we were doing. I had the passion for the so what. We were helping youth. We were doing all sorts of great things. But starting a business is easy. Scaling it is really hard.
Yeah.
And that was what I learned.
That's tough. Okay. So kind of parting last words from you. What one piece of advice would you want to give to other entrepreneurs? Like things that they should know, things that they should think about, things that they should avoid, you know?
Well, I think there's two. One is, you know, that starting a business is easy and scaling a business is hard. And I don't think we put enough emphasis on the scaling part.
Yeah.
The starting part is sexy. It's fun. It's, you know, hey, I've got this intellectual property. I've got this great idea. I'm going to protect it. But the very unsexy part, which is really the hardest, is the scaling part. It's the channel strategy. It's going to market. It's all that stuff which doesn't make for good reality TV.
Right?
That's not going to show up on Shark Tank. That's not. That's the hard part. And making sure that you surround yourself with people who have done that part before is critical. Like at Now Account, a couple of years ago, we hired a classmate of mine from Harvard to be our CFO. And if you looked at his resume, you would say, oh, well, he's perfect. His name's Archie Jones. You know, he's got a CPA. He was in private equity. But that's a small part of why we really wanted him to join the team. The bigger part is that he had invested in a company that they had then scaled and eventually sold to IBM for, I think, $1.3 billion. And what I said to him is, you know what that feels like.
Yeah.
I don't know what that feels like when there's a B at the end of your valuation, right? And I do know that if we don't get there, it's not going to be because of the business plan. It's going to be because something with the culture or the people or the organization, all those things that we kind of take for granted is what would tank us. And you know what that feels like. So there are times when I get stressed about something doesn't feel right, and he's the first one to say, it's okay, right? Like, this is fine.
Yeah.
Because again, he's scaled that mountain before, and he knows where the cliffs are and where the parts are that you could fall off. And that's maybe even more important than his technical financial skills, right? Is having somebody on the team that knows what that feels like.
So from your perspective, do you value that experience more than that kind of the learning, the book learning?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I hire more for mindsets than skill sets.
Okay.
There's very little that I can't teach you how to do that I need you to do. I mean, I'm not hiring brain surgeons here, right?
Or rocket scientists.
We have that covered. But there's very little we can't show you how to do. What we can't teach is mindsets. You know, that resilience mindset to have a good day and a bad day and live through to the next good day. Or just the...
So how do you screen for that? How do you screen for that good mindset? What is there a question you ask? Is there something you look for?
You know, it happens before the interview. One of the things we don't do a lot is I think most companies have recruiting backwards. Because you come up with a job description, you define your box, and then you go find somebody to fit it.
Right.
People don't fit boxes. That's just not the way it works. And I instead, when I meet people and I work with them in another capacity, I'll be like, we need to hire that person. I don't know what the job is yet,
right,
but that person needs to be on our team.
Yeah,
because I can see the mindset. I see the service mindset. I see how they treat me. I've even met people at Publix before that are helping me like bag my groceries. And I'm like, do you go to school? Yes. When you're done with school, here's my card, right? You need to come work with us because I can see their optimism. I see their energy level. I see how they solve problems. I see how they deal with people that are negative. And all of that cannot be taught. But that's the most important part to serving our clients.
Yeah.
Is dealing with an issue and dealing with it positively and seeing an issue as an opportunity as opposed to throwing your hands up and, oh my God, I can't do this. And I think, you know, where I first learned that when I was coming out of Harvard, I was doing a field study for Disney. And Disney was interviewing for a financial analyst. And I didn't sign up for the interview because I had no desire to be a financial analyst. And the head of my field study said, I don't see your name on the interview list. You have to interview. I said, but I don't want to be a financial analyst. He said, but you got to interview anyway. So, okay. So I signed up. I went in. The interviewer walked in. And his first question was, so tell me what you'd like to do. So I told him. It didn't sound at all like a financial analyst. And he looked at me confused. He said, you know, we're interviewing for a financial analyst. And I said, but that's not the question you asked me. You asked me what I wanted to do. And he got up and he left, which is probably a bad sign in the middle of an interview. But he came back in and he said, you know, I'm going to be here until tomorrow afternoon. If you can have at my hotel a one-page description of your dream job, I'll see what we can do. And I ended up getting an offer for my dream job. It was to work with Michael Eisner. But I never would have had that. I could have answered the question the way I knew he wanted me to answer it,
right,
which was a financial analyst.
Right.
And I probably could have gotten the job. And 6 months later, I would have been miserable and they would have been miserable.
Right.
So, you know, if I had another piece of advice, it's like really be honest with yourself about what you want to do.
Yeah.
And that goes for entrepreneurs too, because I think 90% of the time your greatest idea is going to have absolutely nothing to do with what your major was in college or what your job is now or what your area of expertise is. And you know what? That's okay. Like, give yourself permission to have an amazing idea that's not in your area of expertise. Because I think all too often I meet people and they have these great ideas, but they discard them because they're like, oh, well, I'm not in biotech. Well, find somebody who is.
Right.
And let them help you. My greatest ideas, I mean, I've started a water company for children. I knew nothing about that. I started a footwear company other than the fact that I played sports. I knew nothing about that. And now I run a payments company and I don't even like finance. But it's because I saw a problem and I was on the demand side. And all innovation comes from the demand side of problems.
Right.
I knew that I could figure it out and find people to help me figure it out. Because I think all innovation comes from the demand side of a problem, not the supply side.
And with that, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Our question of the week is, if you have an idea for a company, what is the first step you should take?
So what is the first step you should take? You should probably talk to some people, right?
Yeah.
I would say you should talk to some people, some customers. Potential customers.
Potential customers. That's good. Yeah. Customer discoveries, everything, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the trap that a lot of folks fall into is that they want to just tell people what their solution is before understanding what the problems are that their customers have. So I think that's probably our biggest recommendation is don't do that. Just talk. Go talk to customers, right? When you were doing your startup right now, You guys did that, right? You went and talked to customers and didn't tell them your solution first.
Yeah.
I hope
yeah.
you did that.
At what point do you think you should actually incorporate your company and do all the paperwork?
I think you should do that. Well, I think you got to make sure that you've got something that's worth protecting first, right? You want to wait a little bit because everybody has ideas. I think you want to wait and make sure that it's something actually marketable, something that somebody cares about that's willing to pay for it, right? The more important thing is having a business that survives and succeeds, not making your idea successful.